This critique examines Life First, a white paper advocating for viability budgeting, a framework that prioritizes essential life support systems over financial constraints to prevent structural violence.
The material makes a strong case for redesigning macroeconomic sequencing by highlighting the profound difference between real physical limits and artificial accounting constraints. So let's jump right into how we can strengthen this already robust foundation.
Addressing the systemic incentives of current financial power structures will significantly strengthen the feasibility of the global integration strategies.
Right, yeah.
Because right now the weakness is that the text acknowledges this concept of transition friction, you know, the inevitable pushback from asset holders and external creditors.
Mm-hmm.
But it bypasses a deep analytical exploration of how to structurally counter or incentivize those entrenched global actors.
Exactly. It just breezes past it.
Yeah. By quickly moving past the motivations of the institutions that currently benefit from debt dependence and sprinting straight into public mobilization, the argument leaves a gap regarding how a nation practically overcomes resistance from international financial intermediaries.
You're completely right about that gap. I mean, it's one thing to mobilize the public around a localized budget.
Sure.
But I wonder if we've fully considered how heavily a vulnerable nation's fiscal policy is dictated by those exact external forces.
Oh, entirely.
A finance minister in a highly indebted country can't just ignore the International Monetary Fund or private bondholders. So, to resolve this, the suggestion is to deepen the analysis of debt conditionality and transition friction by presenting a concrete mechanism for why international lenders should willingly adopt viability floors.
Right, aligning their interests.
Exactly. We have to show how you align the creditor's long-term financial interests with the societal stability of the borrowing nation. We need a compelling argument that brings these massive financial institutions to the table voluntarily.
Rather than just assuming we can bulldoze past them.
Right, because you can't.
The material already brilliantly dissects how structural violence manifests when symbolic accounting rules override actual survival constraints.
Mm-hmm.
But if we want to convince a global creditor to abandon those traditional accounting rules, we have to speak their language.
Risk and return.
Risk and return. Exactly. There is no single silver bullet here. But a highly effective concrete example would be to expand Section 6.5, which covers debt and conditionality.
Okay, yeah.
To model a detailed negotiation scenario, paint a picture of a developing nation successfully negotiating a viability floor with an external creditor.
I like that.
Walk the reader through the exact arguments that a finance minister would use in that room to prove that protecting domestic water infrastructure is actually a prerequisite for servicing foreign debt.
Building on that specific scenario, what if we looked at it purely from the perspective of systemic risk management for the creditor?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, another concrete example would be to demonstrate mathematically, or even just through a robust theoretical model, how protecting a community's healthcare infrastructure prevents a total economic collapse.
Which secures the debt.
Exactly. Thereby securing a higher probability of long-term debt repayment. Is there a risk that focusing solely on the moral imperative of life support systems might overlook the cold, hard calculus of international finance?
Yeah, you have to play the game to change it.
Think about it. If a nation's public health capacity is stripped down to the bone just to meet an arbitrary debt target, and a pandemic or a massive natural disaster hits,
the debt defaults anyway.
The resulting social unrest and economic halt guarantee that the debt will default anyway.
That's the exact leverage point. A key theme running through this material seems to be the shift from fragility cycles to stability cycles.
Mm-hmm.
You can use that exact framework to show creditors that their own austerity demands actually destroy their own investments.
Right.
If you want to get highly technical with the solutions, another concrete example would be to introduce a theoretical resilience bond structure into the framework.
Oh, a resilience bond? Tell me more about that.
So this would be a completely new financial instrument that explicitly guarantees creditor returns only if the borrowing nation's viability floor metrics remain above a certain threshold.
Wow.
Yeah. So if essential medicine inventories, public safety readiness, or water treatment uptime drop below the viability floor,
the creditor gets penalized.
The creditor's yield is penalized. Exactly.
That is fascinating because it entirely flips the incentive structure.
It does.
Could the historical evidence support the conclusion that creditors intentionally rely on fragility cycles to extract more wealth through structural adjustment programs?
Oh, absolutely. There's a strong case for that.
If that's the case, the resilience bond concept is incredibly disruptive. It legally forces the external creditor to actively root for and financially support the maintenance of the borrowing nation's life support systems.
They become stakeholders.
You are essentially turning a predatory global creditor into a vested stakeholder in the local viability floor. If the city's water system fails, the Wall Street bondholder loses money.
I love how that mechanism bridges the gap. By outlining these specific negotiation models and introducing financial instruments like the resilience bond, the white paper moves from being a profound sociological critique into an actionable policy toolkit for finance ministers.
Yeah. It answers the immediate burning question of the policymaker in a highly indebted nation, which is, how do I legally protect my municipal water infrastructure when international creditors are demanding a balanced budget by Friday?
And it directly addresses the transition friction mentioned back in Section 4.5 without relying entirely on grassroots idealism.
Right. Power concedes nothing without a structural reason. If you map out exactly how an international lender benefits from a viability floor, proving that societal continuity ensures economic output, which in turn ensures debt servicing,
you disarm those artificial constraints at their very source.
It makes the entire macroeconomic sequencing argument airtight.
So let's pivot to the methodology, because integrating the actual human-AI collaborative process into the core narrative will capitalize on a highly unique methodological angle.
Yes, let's talk about this.
When I was reviewing the document, I noticed something incredible buried at the very end. The weakness here is that ChatGPT 5.2 is credited as a co-author in the author bios for its computational pattern recognition and its ability to synthesize cross-domain theory.
Right.
Yet the main text itself does not reflect how this incredible synthesis actually occurred. The paper reads in a very unified, traditional academic voice, leaving the groundbreaking story of how clinical systems biology and macroeconomic theory were successfully merged entirely untold.
When I saw that bio, my mind was absolutely blown.
Same.
What are the potential limitations or counterarguments to keeping that collaboration entirely behind the scenes? I suppose one might argue that a formal policy paper should focus solely on the findings and the framework, not the process of how it was written, to avoid distracting the reader.
Sure, that's the traditional view.
However, my suggestion to remedy this weakness is to explicitly weave the story of this interdisciplinary collaboration right into the introduction or to create a dedicated methodology section.
I completely agree.
Doing so will massively enhance the framework's innovative appeal. You have to demonstrate exactly how this framework was built, step by step, rather than just handing the reader the final result and expecting them to trust the jump between disciplines.
Think about the author's background. The author is a physician trained in internal medicine.
Right.
They are trained to look at a human body, diagnose failing life support systems, and prescribe interventions to stabilize the patient before worrying about anything else.
Exactly.
The AI was clearly utilized to scale that exact biological diagnostic framework up to the level of municipal and national economies. This is brilliant, but right now it's completely invisible to the reader until page 40.
Which is way too late.
Way too late. There are a few different ways the author could bring this to the forefront, but a great concrete example would be to add a brief methodological box right in the introduction.
Good idea.
Detail exactly how the AI was used to map biological resilience models, like human cellular shock absorbers or physiological homeostasis, directly onto municipal budgeting structures.
Is the connection between clinical diagnostics and municipal accounting fully established in the material as it stands, or is that an area to potentially bolster?
It definitely needs bolstering early on.
Building on your example, another concrete step would be to include a short section explaining how the distinct lenses of internal medicine and large-scale computational knowledge synthesis identified the artificial constraints blind spots that traditional economists almost always miss.
Right, because they aren't trained to see them.
Think about the fundamental difference in training. A traditional economist is trained to look at financial ratios, deficits, and ledgers. A doctor is trained to look at vital signs, oxygen saturation, and organ failure.
And the AI bridges that
urgency of a crashing patient into the language of fiscal policy.
What I really appreciate about this angle is how it embodies the white paper's own call for rewriting our cultural narratives.
Yeah.
The current monetary system operates on a scarcity myth, and overcoming that requires a completely new way of processing information,
Another concrete example for improvement would be to frame the concept of the viability floor not just as an economic theory, but as an applied biological principle translated into fiscal policy via this unique co-authorship.
I love that framing.
By showing the reader the actual mechanics of how a medical doctor and an artificial intelligence collaborated to diagnose the structural violence of modern capitalism, you create a captivating narrative hook that pulls the reader in immediately.
That framing makes so much sense, but could we anticipate some readers viewing AI co-authorship skeptically?
Definitely. There's always pushback.
I think addressing that skepticism head-on is exactly why this methodology needs to be totally transparent. If you hide it, it feels like a gimmick. If you explain it, it becomes a rigorous methodology.
Exactly.
You position the AI not as an autonomous writer spinning up text, but as a computational pattern recognition tool that processed decades of peace theory, behavioral research, and public finance literature to validate the physician's clinical hypothesis.
It grounds it in data.
It proves to the reader that viability budgeting isn't just an abstract political philosophy. It is a biologically sound system of governance backed by massive data synthesis.
The material makes such a strong case for viability budgeting by drawing on Johann Galtung's triangle of structural, cultural, and direct violence.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you actually measure structural violence in the real world? You measure it by looking at the deferred maintenance on a municipal water pipe or the dangerous staffing levels at a primary healthcare clinic.
Right.
By detailing how the human-AI partnership connected high-level peace theory to localized infrastructure decay, you give the reader a masterclass in interdisciplinary problem solving. It shows exactly how the theory maps onto reality.
Exactly. And it sets a powerful precedent for how future macroeconomic policies should be designed. They shouldn't be designed in a vacuum by financial theorists looking only at GDP growth.
No, they fail when they do that.
They should be designed through a deep synthesis of lived clinical experience, ecological data, and advanced computational modeling. By putting the methodology front and center, it turns the white paper itself into a living, breathing example of the innovation it advocates for in Section 3.6.
Creating a sharper bridge between high-level macroeconomic theory and granular municipal accounting will make the local implementation pathways more immediately usable for policymakers.
Let's get into the micro-level stuff.
The argument here is incredibly foundational, but the structural weakness is that the transition from discussing massive conceptual frameworks like systemic violence or the psychology of scarcity to managing local municipal water utility budgets feels quite abrupt.
It's a bit of a whiplash.
Yeah, a reader, whether they are a national policymaker, an academic economist, or a local city official, is going to struggle to map these high-level psychological and cultural shifts directly onto the rigid, day-to-day accounting software and ledgers they are forced to interact with.
The sheer friction of bureaucratic reality is something we have to deeply consider here.
Totally.
A city manager might read this white paper and completely agree that our current monetary architecture is a form of structural violence. They might have a profound paradigm shift while reading.
Sure.
But on Friday afternoon, they still have to balance the town budget using legacy municipal software.
Right.
And they still have to present that budget to a city council that only cares about the bottom line. So the suggestion to fix this gap is to provide a step-by-step narrative or technical bridge that illustrates the exact mechanical moment of institutional redesign at the micro level.
We have to see it in action.
We need to show the reader exactly what a transition from an austerity budget to a viability budget looks like on actual paper.
Yes, Section 8.6 talks beautifully about the quiet radicalism of maintenance.
Such a great phrase.
It is, but we need to see what that radicalism looks like inside an Excel spreadsheet.
Exactly.
Let's outline some concrete examples for how the author could build this bridge. Keep in mind that there are many ways to solve this, but one highly practical approach would be to significantly enhance Section 5.2 or Appendix B with a step-by-step hypothetical walkthrough of a town council rewriting a specific local ordinance.
I like the idea of showing the actual wording.
Show us the exact wording. Show us the debate where a city official successfully argues that a viability floor must legally supersede discretionary spending caps.
Building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of the actual accounting columns?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Another fantastic concrete example would be to show a localized before and after ledger. Visually detail how a specific line item, like chemical supply buffers for the municipal water treatment plant, is shifted.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Show it moving from a discretionary,
easily cut maintenance category over to a legally protected viability mandate. Walk the reader through the exact accounting classifications that have to change in the software to make structural violence impossible to execute.
I can clearly see how that grounds the theory. Another powerful concrete example to bridge this macro-micro divide would be to provide a sample script or a procedural rule that a local housing authority could adopt to legally shield its maintenance budget during a localized fiscal contraction.
Hand them the tools.
Give these local city officials the exact legal terminology they need to present to their municipal boards. If you want them to execute viability budgeting, you have to hand them the administrative weapons to do so.
That is so critical. Is the connection between cultural narratives and line item vetoes fully established in the material?
Not quite yet.
By providing this extremely granular bridge, you prove that overcoming artificial constraints isn't just about changing our minds or having a philosophical awakening. It's about fundamentally changing the administrative rules.
The rules dictate the reality.
Think about how austerity works in practice. If a budget shortfall hits, traditional rules dictate cutting maintenance first because it's the path of least resistance.
It always is.
A viability budget forces the municipal software or the legal framework to reject that cut outright because the viability floor has a hard-coded non-negotiable priority over all other discretionary spending.
A key theme running through this material seems to be that money is essentially just a coordination tool. Viability mapping, which is brilliantly discussed in Section 5.5, reveals that a community's greatest fear is the failure of the primary healthcare clinic's emergency response capacity. The local policymaker needs a rigorous template for how to lock that funding away from the austerity acts.
Right.
They can't just rely on good intentions. They need the administrative mechanism.
And I wonder if there is a concern that getting into hyper-specific municipal ledgers might alienate national-level readers who are more interested in the macroeconomic theory.
That's a fair question.
I would argue the exact opposite. I think it actually validates and grounds the national theory. If a national finance minister sees that this framework functions flawlessly at the level of a municipal water utility, they gain the practical confidence to apply the viability floor concept to national foreign exchange reserves or sovereign debt negotiations.
It scales up.
The micro-level execution proves the macro-level theory is viable.
Absolutely. The text states that small states and local governance act as viability laboratories. But a laboratory requires a highly detailed procedural manual to run its experiments.
Exactly.
By creating this mechanical bridge, the sample ledgers, the ordinance scripts, the literal accounting shifts, you equip the reader not just to understand viability budgeting in an academic sense, but to walk into their office and deploy it the very next day.
It transforms the document entirely. It takes it from an abstract economic treatise and turns it into an administrative weapon against structural violence.
Yeah, a real tool.
When you give a local official the exact budgetary mechanism to protect their community's life support systems, you empower them to break the fragility cycle in real time. That is how you drive systemic change.
This critique highlighted the immense strength of the viability budgeting concept while offering three distinct avenues for refinement: addressing the systemic incentives of global creditors, weighting the unique human AI methodological story into the text, and building a more granular bridge between macroeconomic theory and local accounting practices.
To implement these suggestions, we recommend expanding the global scaling section to include a negotiation model with external creditors, potentially utilizing theoretical resilience bonds.
Right.
Also, pull that methodology out of the bio and add a dedicated section on how clinical biological systems were mapped to fiscal policy using computational pattern recognition.
That's huge.
And finally, provide a localized before and after ledger with procedural scripts to empower municipal policymakers on the ground.
The underlying material here is incredibly robust and vital. We highly encourage you to apply these structural refinements and submit the revised work back in for another critique to continue sharpening this essential framework.